counsel will each have 15 minutes for your argument. Appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. If you can please introduce yourself and the party you represent at the beginning of your argument, we would greatly appreciate it. That helps for the recording. And there is a timer that you can see on the podium there that hopefully will be visible while you're doing your argument. So you can proceed when you're ready.
Dan, would you prefer me to stand here or at the main podium?
I think at the closer podium would be great. Thank you.
Please, the court. My name is Michael McLaughlin. I'm an attorney from the Public Defender's Office, and I represent the appellant, Christina Bonstead, on this case. Christina Bonstead appeals from the district court's order revoking her probation. Minnesota policy favors keeping individuals on probation when it can be done safely and when there are still community resources available to further the individual's rehabilitation. A district court does have discretion to determine that a need for confinement outweighs those policies favoring probation in an individual case. But at the same time, a revocation of probation cannot be based on a mere exertion of will by the district court. It has to be based on a judgment that follows the analysis required under Austin and Motland and the other case law. A district court abuses its discretion when it revokes based on an erroneous understanding of law. It also abuses its discretion when it fails to conduct the required analysis. In that case, the court does not exercise its discretion at all as the law provides for it. And here, both types of abuse of discretion occurred in this case. The district court both relied on a misunderstanding of law, and it failed to properly exercise the discretion as it's required to do under Austin and Motland. Begin with its abuse of discretion by relying on an erroneous understanding of law. The Supreme Court's held that probation cannot be revoked based on an accumulation of technical violations. Austin held that the fact that if it's a technical violation, the fact that an individual's had a prior technical violation cannot be used as a justification for revocation. The district court here violated that rule by revoking based on the fact that Ms. Bonstead had repeat violations for missing tests. And a missed test is a technical violation as Minnesota statute defines it. A violation is technical if it does not involve a criminal act that is alleged in a formal complaint. Here, the missed tests were not a criminal act, so they do qualify as a technical violation under Minnesota law. And the district court actually earlier in Ms. Bonstead's supervision on a prior hearing characterized missing tests as a technical violation. I mean, I don't mean to overstate it and minimize it too much. It was still a violation of probation, but it's one that Minnesota law defines as technical rather than non-technical. And as such, missed tests, even though they occurred more than once, could not provide a basis for revocation. But the district court said expressly on the record in explaining its decision to revoke, you know, this is not a first-time case. You've been given chance after chance to get where you needed to get to, and you've not done that. You continue to miss tests. So
I'm going to interrupt because I think that there may be I don't want to say oversimplification, it's a little too strong, but as I'm trying to figure out on the argument about whether something is a technical violation or not, there are cases that characterize missed tests as serious violations and not technical only, and especially if drug use was a factor to begin with. Do you think that those cases are just incorrect, given the language and the statute that you're arguing, or do you think there is maybe some more nuance than simply saying drug tests, missed, failed, those are technical as a matter of statute? Look at the language in the statute, end of story, right? Or is there some nuance there?
I mean, I think there is a range of severity within violations, even if they don't involve new criminal acts. So I know some of the case law has discussed things that aren't criminal still being serious. Now, I wouldn't dispute that, but going back again to kind of the fundamental framework that the Supreme Court set out for probation revocation, where the presumption is keep the person on probation, and you need to have a real need for confinement that overrides that interest of continued probation. That's where a more narrow reading of technical makes sense, where it really requires more to get someone off of probation and into prison. And so, you know, while the case law has, you know, made the point that even something that's non-criminal may be serious, I wouldn't dispute that, but still the statute does expressly say what's technical. And I think that makes sense in terms of, under Austin, you don't want, you know, the fact that an individual has repeated things that don't require a need for confinement. The fact that something doesn't require confinement, even if it happens multiple times, that doesn't change that it doesn't require confinement. And I think that was the point of Austin. Like, this doesn't require sending someone to prison. We don't care if it's happened before. It still doesn't require sending someone to prison because we want people to stay on probation when possible.
One of my concerns here, and just evaluating the district court's exercise of discretion, is that these were not missed tests, you know, over the span of a five-year period. My understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, was that Ms. Bonstad was required to test for a 30-day period once a year as part of her sentence. And if that is correct, and we're looking at the district court's exercise of discretion, wouldn't the district court have been within its right to characterize, you know, 10 missed tests within 30 days of a testing period as more than a technical violation?
I don't believe it would have been within its discretion to do that because of the way the statute is written, but that doesn't mean that the court couldn't have taken those violations seriously, and it had a range of options available to it other than revocation. It could have imposed all sorts of intermediate sanctions as a consequence if it thought that they were a serious problem, but the district court didn't do that here either. I don't mean to minimize the missed test because that, you know, that was a clear violation of probation, and it's something that, you know, the district court would have been fully justified in looking into more. But, you know, the fundamental problem, and going to kind of the second way that we argue the district court abuses discretion, is it never considered any of that. So the third Austin factor says that, you know, the district court has to find that a need for confinement outweighs the interests of, under Minnesota policy, of keeping someone on probation. For something to outweigh, you first need to weigh. You need to weigh the interest under Minnesota law of keeping this person in the community. The district court never did that initial weighing of the value of keeping Ms. Bonstad in community, and it never considered whether there were still treatment resources available to her.
So, counsel, the district court did consider the three sub-factors under that third prong. And is it your view that that's not sufficient?
The way that it is our view, and the way that the district court used the factors in this case, it's not sufficient. The factors still are sub-factors under the broader question of, does the need for confinement outweigh the interest favoring probation? The court never did that first step of weighing the interest of continued probation. It just cited two reasons that supported confinement, but you need both parts of the analysis in our view under Motland and Austin. The court needs to look at, you know, what Minnesota policy would be served by keeping Ms. Bonstad out in the community.
Isn't that part of what those three sub-factors look at? Like, as you're weighing these two values, you have to consider whether the violations would depreciate the seriousness of being on probation if probation wasn't revoked, and 10 missed tests seems to be exactly the kind of thing that could depreciate the seriousness of that condition. If you don't follow the condition 10 different times, how serious is that condition going to be? And I don't see that as an improper way of analyzing the third Austin factor.
I'd say that the first part of the third Austin factor looks at the rehabilitation interest that's served by keeping the individual in the community. So it doesn't look at, you know, whether it'll undermine a condition of probation because it'll depreciate the seriousness of the condition. It looks at, you know, can this individual still be rehabilitated in the community? That's why Austin and Motland have said that probation should not be revoked unless as a last resort when treatment has failed. So a court needs to look at that. It needs to ask that question, and the district court didn't do that. The district court, you know, recited the sub-factor that unduly depreciate the seriousness. And it said that, you know, it had an explanation for public safety. But it never weighed that against the benefit for rehabilitation of keeping her in the community. And here there was a real rehabilitation benefit of keeping her out. She'd done treatment. She'd been successful in treatment.
One thing that I got in my reading of the transcript, I mean, there was a pretty lengthy interaction that occurred between the district court and your client during the disposition hearing. And during the course of that discussion and based on the district court's comments following that discussion, it seemed to me that the district court was also making a credibility determination and finding that that Ms. Bonstant wasn't being entirely truthful, and that what was going on here was maybe more than missed tests. What was going on here was not complying with probation and the, you know, prescription against alcohol. How are we to factor the district court's credibility determination into our review?
We'd argue that the district court did do that, but it wasn't a credibility determination. I mean, Ms. Bonstant, or at least it wasn't a credibility as to anything relating to the violations. Ms. Bonstant admitted to the violation. You know, the court accepted that admission and found it credible. What the court did was it appeared to rely on events that were never alleged as a violation, that Ms. Bonstant never had a fair opportunity to respond to, and use that to influence a decision to revoke. And, you know, we argue in our brief at length about why that was improper and why that shouldn't be relied on. And, I mean, the basic point I'd make is if a court can do that, it circumvents the whole process. I mean,
Did defense counsel ask to have a contested hearing on the third factor?
I mean, they asked for a disposition hearing to argue whether she should...
Well, but to present evidence, I mean, we see that frequently, that district courts will hold a contested evidentiary hearing regarding any facts that might relate to weighing of those two competing values in the third factor. I don't see that being requested in this case, right?
No, it wasn't requested. I mean, it was a dispositional hearing was requested, and I mean, I think at issue in any dispositional hearing is whether the need for confinement outweighs the policies favoring probation.
Right, but there's a difference between arguments or what a court can rely on at that hearing in order to, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we have case law that suggests hearsay is admissible on probation violation as opposed from the disposition, like the consequences phase, the liability phase. We know hearsay is available for the liability phase. At a contested hearing, there are federal cases that say Crawford doesn't apply to this kind of a case. So what is improper at the consequences phase when there is no request to have an evidentiary hearing? What's improper about the district court hearing arguments and trying to weigh those based on things that are outside of the admissions that were made?
Well, just to start, the hearsay is admissible, but there are limits to it. It has to be reliable hearsay. You know, in the case law, it has put some fairly meaningful limits on a court's ability to hear hearsay evidence in a probation violation hearing. But what was especially problematic in this case is that it was never offered as evidence by the state. It was never...
The court also said, this is what the report says, there are these allegations, but just so you know, I'm not considering that in making my disposition here. So shouldn't we take the court at face value that it didn't actually consider those allegations?
I mean, I just ask that this court look at the entire record, because the court did say that at one point, that it wasn't going to be the base of revocation, but it made other statements, you know, talking about how concerning they were, how we've got, you know, we have a problem here because of these community reports. I mean, it appeared to figure into the analysis, even though I acknowledge the court did make the statement that it wasn't going to be the basis for revocation, but it did figure it into its analysis. I think if the transcript's looked at as a whole and look at all the statements that the court made about that hearsay material. And, you know, I mean, the state probation could have alleged that as a violation. I mean, I think the fact that they declined to do so, even though all those statements were made back in January, 3 months before the violation report was brought, they didn't include them as violations. I mean, that suggests that probation didn't find them credible. And notably, probation wanted to keep Ms. Bonstadt in the community. It wanted to reinstate her to probation with intermediate sanctions. So the people that knew the most about those allegations decided they weren't worth filing as violations, and they weren't a basis for revocation. So I'll reserve the rest of my argument during rebuttal.
Thank you.
It pleases the court. My name is Todd Zettler. I represent respondent, the state of Minnesota. I'll start with the issue that Judge Bryan brought up, which is the technical violation as defined by statute. And I will confess that it was the first time looking at appellant's brief that I saw that there was a statute that defined technical, because there's a difference historically between a technical violation of probation, which is sort of de minimis and isn't considered very serious, and technical in the statute, which then isn't defined, other than to say it's not a subsequent criminal offense. And we know that cases are violated, probation is revoked for technical violations all the time, every day, across the state of Minnesota. And there is nothing wrong with that. And in fact, even Austin, which says it can't be just an accumulation of technical violations, affirmed revoking probation in that case on a technical violation as defined by statute, apparently in Minnesota. So technical violation does not mean not a revocable violation. It simply is a statement used in that statute, which I think differs from the common understanding of what a technical violation is, which is not very serious. Because in this case, by the time they got to the end here, these violations were viewed very seriously. And in fact, they were right from the very get-go. Now, I will say one thing, which is on the very first violation back in 2016, when she had that first violation, the judge said that this is in the nature of a technical violation for missing four tests, when probation was still saying, we want to keep her on probation, we want to work with her. That was in the nature of a technical violation. But thereafter, that was not the case. And in fact, Hennepin County on the next violation said, despite the fact that she's doing well overtly in the treatment programs that she's in, she continues to fail to test, she continues to use alcohol. So they were already concerned back in 2017. The idea argued by appellant that missed tests cannot provide a basis for revocation is simply false. It can. It does. I also agree that the judge did make a credibility determination at that hearing, after hearing from Ms. Bonstadt at the probation revocation disposition hearing.
Can I ask you to back up a bit? You know, as we're looking at the different parts of this analysis, I'm wondering what how you distinguish the two-part hearing, the initial hearing. It's characterized by appellant as the initial probation revocation or violation hearing. And I'm curious to hear if you're conceding that that was an initial violation hearing where the rules would have required certain advisories that were not given.
No. And I guess I need to be clear on which hearings that is, because there's the motion hearing, which...
Well, the notice for that hearing, I guess we should refer to it by date. I think it's April 30. The notice for that hearing included both motions as what was being heard. And so I guess that's the question, is how do you characterize that April 30th hearing? And are you conceding that it was an initial hearing on the violation?
No. It was a hearing on her motion to be discharged from probation early. And that's clear from...
But Mr. Zettler, wasn't she summoned to that hearing as part of... following probation's filing of a violation report?
Yeah, and that was an interesting point made.
And didn't the order post-hearing refer to both motions?
Yeah, and it does. And so initially, you have motion hearing, April 30th, 2021. Just motion hearing, that's all it says. But this is also a state court form. So this isn't Scott County form. This is the state court form for Zoom hearings. And so it says, even on her motion hearing, that if you fail to appear, a warrant may be issued for your arrest. That's in every one of these. That's in, I've come to find out, every criminal notice that goes out like this in the state of Minnesota right now. It was merged, and the next notice does say probation violation and motion hearing, April 30th. Again, the warrant notice. So that did occur. And I agree that that notice does say that, but that's not what happened once they got there. So when you look at the transcript, it's called the motion hearing. When you look at what actually happened at the hearing, all they talked about was the motion.
Except so, that her motion kind of had to do with the probation violation too, right?
It did. And so the prosecution at that hearing
said, I have a hard time reaching that conclusion as easily as it seems you have, not just because the sort of interrelativity of the two motions, but also the open-ended nature of the judge's question could, to me, relate to one, both, either. So maybe you can explain why you're not conceding that that's error.
I'm not sure when I look at the motion hearing transcript called motion hearing, and I read through the transcript multiple times, the only way that the probation violation is mentioned at the motion hearing is that there is a probation violation that has been filed. So we're not going to decide the motion until that is dealt with. And that was dealt with at the next hearing. So she never made it an admission. The judge didn't ask her any facts about it. It was kept completely separate. So the prosecution opposed early release because there was a violation filed, and the judge ultimately denied it because there was a probation violation filed as well, but it was kept completely separate. So, and I think when you read the motion hearing transcript, and it's short, there's not much in it, there is no substantive dealing with a probation violation, none.
I'll just note, though, I have read that transcript, and she does make admissions.
She makes admissions all over the place, yeah. Absolutely. And she makes admissions in her motion papers.
Doesn't the district court have an obligation to say, whoa, 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 or better yet, to ask the question in a certain way, to ask the question not, is there anything I should know, right? But shouldn't the district court have confined that question to the motion that it was considering if it is so clear? And I've read the transcript as well. So if it is that clear, why are we having this discussion? Obviously, there's more the court could have done to make it clear.
Because the judge was responding to the motion that she had filed. And she filed a motion that had lots of attachments and had lots of admissions in her motion paperwork. So she admitted missing tests. She admitted to never being able to make these tests, that it's been a problem the entire time she's been on probation.
Right, but I'm just trying to characterize that hearing. And are we characterizing that as the initial violation hearing or not?
No. It's a motion. It's a hearing on her motion to be discharged early, and that's it. Because otherwise, what would you say? I mean, what happened there? Did she admit? Did she deny? No, she didn't do any of those.
Well, I think there are things we can look
at. Are you saying it's of no import that the notice said it's a probation violation and motion hearing?
I am. I'm saying that court administration inadvertently, or not inadvertently, but they added that on there because in a criminal case, you try to deal with everything at every hearing. So that's what the notice said. I do concede that absolutely.
And the district court's order.
In the district court's order?
The order denying the early discharge motion referred to the April 30 hearing as a hearing on both motions.
Well, I'm not sure that makes it so, though, because he doesn't do anything with the probation violation in this denial. in the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order on May 17th of 2021. He doesn't do anything else with the probation violation. I mean, there's no doubt that they both existed at the same time. The motion was pending, and there was the violation filed. No question.
And let me ask you this. It looks like if you read her attachment to the motion, it looks to me like she knew that there was a probation violation coming at the time that she filed the motion.
She did, yes.
Is there an argument to be made that she was kind of trying to head off the violation by making the motion for early discharge? I just don't understand the relationship between the two things.
And I don't think that there was. I think she was trying to get off. Well, the motion doesn't, it mentions that there is a violation out there, but then it, on her actual handwritten motion, has nothing to do with that. It's all about she wants off because she's going to school and it affects her mentally to be on probation. It's stressful, and she is going to be an EMT, so she has to apply for things like that. But it doesn't say anything about the violation. The only place that that's mentioned is in her then letter of support attached to her motion.
Her own letter.
And I'm sorry if I focused us on that first part of the plain error analysis when the bulk of the questions, as I think of them, on appellant's argument focused more on the third part. So I don't mean to hijack or have you focus on something you didn't want to focus on. Go ahead.
I'm going to rely on my brief mainly for everything. So any questions that you...
Well, yeah, I think what Judge Brian wants you to address and what I want to hear you talk about too is... assuming there was plain error, at that first appearance on the probation violation / motion hearing, the plain error being what appellant is arguing, that the district court didn't advise her that she had a right to counsel and of her other rights, you know, associated with having a probation violation. Assuming that's a plain error, what is your argument as to the prejudice of any error there?
There is none. I mean, there's no prejudice.
And why not?
Because she had already made all of the admissions prior to even showing up. She made them in her moving papers. She certainly spoke more while she was there. And furthermore, thereafter, when she then made the next appearance with her lawyer, they never said anything. They never said, wait a minute, we want to undo this. And they certainly could have. She's never claimed, never once, not to this day, that she would not have made the admissions. She would have not made the admissions and argued for continued probation.
I think that's what appellant's brief says, though. Cat was out of the bag. I think that's sort of what the argument was. You know, she went to that first appearance, she made all the admissions, and then she was sort of stuck with no option but to admit to the violation.
Which is completely false. They undo it all the time. So... they could have at least tried. She could have said, filed an affidavit. I didn't mean any of that. I want to undo it. I want to continue probation because I would never have admitted these things. But she didn't do that. Not when she had a lawyer. And she didn't do it after that. She didn't claim in any kind of a post-conviction proceeding that she received ineffective assistance of counsel. She hasn't filed an affidavit that she wouldn't have admitted. So there's only speculation that she wouldn't have admitted had she known, but she had a lawyer. We don't need to guess. She was represented. They could have done that and didn't. And they didn't because she didn't want to. She wanted to argue for continued probation. Are there any other questions? If not, then I would simply ask this court to affirm the district court's exercise of discretion in revoking probation in this case. Thank you.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Thank you. Beginning with the whole question of that April 30th hearing, it was a first appearance on a probation violation. And the reason it was that's the way that Minnesota law defines it. Rule 2704 defines a first appearance is when a probationer initially appears on a summons following an alleged probation violation.
But isn't it possible that the district court had two things going on and decided we're going to continue the second, the probation violation initial hearing? We are not going to have it. We're going to continue that initial hearing for another date, and we're only going to focus on the first motion. Is that a fair reading of what actually happened? I was the one asking the questions about the notice, about the order, so I understand that there are indications to the contrary. But just looking at the transcript, is it possible to look at that and conclude that, as we're characterizing that hearing, that no, that in fact was a continuation for another date of that first hearing, that the first initial probation violation hearing did not occur?
I mean, we would entirely concede that the focus of the hearing was her motion for early discharge, but things happened at that hearing that mattered for the probation violation. And I mean, and that's, as the district court said in its order, that, you know, it had concerns about granting a motion for early discharge when there was a pending probation violation. It said that on the record at the hearing, and so did the prosecutor. So, you know, focus on the motion hearing, but it still was a hearing that was part of the probation violation proceeding. And I,
how was she prejudiced, though, when the letter that she attached to her notice of motion and motion indicated that she had more, you know, recent violations of the testing requirement?
As Judge Gaze said, the prejudice in our view was that it committed her to a strategy of admitting the violations. And
but this was her own filing. I guess that's what I'm trying to get at. You know, even before the hearing, she filed something on her own initiative with the district court. So given that, how was she prejudiced?
There was a difference between a written motion and stating it on the record in open court. So, I mean, that's the first thing I'd say. And also to what respondent's point that she could have, you know, disavowed everything she said at the hearing. Those were still all party admissions that could have been used against her to prove a violation. I mean, the idea that she could have fought a successful defense after that hearing, I think, is just not true. She had no choice after that hearing but to admit, or the state would have proved its violation by what she said at that hearing.
Well, the state could have proved its violation just by referring to the letter that she filed along with her motion, where she says, "I'm currently facing another technical violation due to missing said tests." I mean,
but she still, you know, the Minnesota law and what due process requires is the person on probation had the opportunity to talk to an attorney, and before that first appearance, and to have a right to counsel that first appearance. She didn't have that opportunity. If she had an attorney, she could have clarified things at that initial appearance. Her attorney could have clarified that she's not admitting anything towards the violation as for the probation violation proceeding. But to shift gears a little bit, the two violations occurred at that first hearing. There's this whole question that was dealt with in, like, Bolio, you know, is this a violation of the advisory and is that plain error? But there was also a right to counsel violation. And I'd point the court's attention to the Cuba case, or Cuba. That's relevant in a few ways. They found a violation of the right to counsel at a hearing that wasn't technically a revocation hearing. What it was an extension of a hearing, a voluntary hearing that the defendant brought to extend probation so he could continue in treatment. And the court found that the defendant had a right to counsel at that hearing and that it was violated in that case and it was reversible error. A complete denial of right to counsel is not subject to plain error analysis, is not subject to prejudice analysis. It's a structural error, and that occurred at that first hearing. She had a right to an attorney. Rule 2704 provides that individuals have a right to counsel at all stages of the proceeding. Cuba has interpreted that broadly to include even a voluntary hearing on a probation extension motion. Right to counsel is there too. She had it at that first hearing. She's denied counsel. That's reversible error. I'd take any more questions. But.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel for your arguments here today and your helpful briefing. Matter submitted, and we will issue our decision within the statutory time frame. That concludes the oral portion of our calendar today. We're now in recess.
Thank you. All rise.